Thanks for listening and being a part of the Chris Smith Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hey, good to have your company. We are going to get across this brand new documentary, which is available to be streamed now, on how to poison the planet. And as I said at the start of the program, it's about these everyday chemicals that we come across in simple things like makeup and clothing that are considered forever chemicals, and they are poisoning certain sections of our communities. Added to that, it's also a documentary that takes into consideration many of the other events of poisoning, chemical harm on various communities, particularly in Australia, that you may have known about. And we'll talk about all of that shortly on the program. You would have heard Antony Blinken in that last news bulletin talk about the fact that Egypt and Qatar have done a wonderful job trying to get a peace deal drawn up that may be acceptable between Israel and Hamas. And it would be a great breakthrough if that were the case. I just wanted to give you a little bit more information so you understand where we're up to. The United States stepped up pressure for a ceasefire deal in Gaza, as the Secretary of State said a new proposal had been put to Hamas, whose officials were in Cairo talking to Egyptian mediators. Israeli airstrikes killed 26 people in Gaza's southernmost town of Rafah, according to hospital records. Blinken, ahead of a visit to Israel this week, urged Hamas to accept the latest proposal, calling it extraordinarily generous on Israel's part. But you can bet that the kind of damage that's been done to human life in places like Rafah is not going to get this peace deal over the line in any quick time. It will cause a great deal of angst on behalf of Hamas, and it could actually prevent any ceasefire agreement. Now, the terms have not been made public, so I can't tell you how many prisoners are being released or whether all the hostages are going to be released. But you would have thought, now that we've got this far away from October 7, that all hostages have to be released. But according to an Egyptian official and Israeli media, Israel has softened its position, lowering the number of hostages it demands that Hamas free during the initial six-week phase. One question is whether that will be enough to overcome Hamas concerns over the ceasefire's second phase, and that is what is being tipped to be the rest of the hostages. So we'll see how that plays out. I mentioned that the NHS was making a major statement in the next few days about biological sex, to define in an NHS context exactly what would happen with those who consider themselves transgender women. I think it's a move in the right direction. Meanwhile, there's another major debate, a bigger debate going on about euthanasia. Jonathan Dimbleby has urged MPs in the UK to get off the fence on the issue of assisted dying, and said public opinion is overwhelmingly in favour of change. Now, after his younger brother Nicholas died after debilitating motor neurone disease earlier this year, Dimbleby said the current law was cruel. He was speaking outside Parliament yesterday at the beginning of a three-hour debate on this law. He said politicians must get off the fence, don't sit on your hands, have a proper full debate about all the implications, and at the end of that, I am sure they will introduce legislation. Whichever way it goes will be very, very interesting. Now, the debate, which did not include a vote, mind you, was held after more than 200,000 people backed a petition calling on the government to change the law. 200,000. The issue was last voted on in the Commons back in 2015, when a motion on legislation was defeated at the second reading stage by 330-118. 330-118. The tip is by many of the commentators in the UK, and you can read any article on this because there are a plenty to read in the last 24 hours, that the tip is it will get over the line because, well, just like in Australia, where we've got various jurisdictions who've actually done the same thing. Okay, let's get on to this quite incredible story. One obvious awakening, I guess, that has emerged since the pandemic is that so much of what we were told during that time has been studied and proven to be total garbage. That New Zealand study in particular of 99 million people showed that the observed adverse cardiac effects of COVID vaccines were three times what was clinically expected. The observed impacts were three times worse than what were clinically expected. Even this week, AstraZeneca, as we discussed with Mark Latham, has admitted to major problems related to blood clotting from its vaccine. Now, the jabs did not prevent the spread or the contraction of COVID, despite what we were told, and lockdowns led to far greater adverse impacts than countries which avoided lockdowns. And I've spoken about this in detail, comparing the east and west coast of the United States and, of course, Australia to Sweden. And since then, I've witnessed here, I think, a huge cynicism about what we're told by health experts and what we digest. Well, when you begin to watch the new Stan documentary, Revealed, How to Poison a Planet, you'll become even more cynical and concerned, I think. This comprehensive investigation, released for the first time this week, delves into the scandalous misuse of forever chemicals in everyday use via things like makeup, clothing, and cookware, for example, many of which you would not be aware of. Katrina McGowan is an Australian filmmaker at Eye Candy Films. She's director of the feature documentary, Revealed, How to Poison a Planet, and she joins us from Sydney right now. Katrina McGowan, welcome to TNT.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
That's okay. Forever chemicals, tell us what they are and what kind of products contain them.
So forever chemicals are known mostly for their stain-resistant, grease-proof and waterproof properties. So they were created in the 1930s and were used initially in products like Scotchgard, food packaging paper that's grease-proof, pizza boxes, anything that you know, takeaway containers, and also famously used in Teflon. So the main properties of them are that they have these non-stick waterproofing qualities and have since sort of been used in a number of other products over the decades.
And so our food contacts this material and we eat and drink the food.
That's right. So earlier on, there were two chemicals that were used more often than others, and those are the two that we know the most. So the PFAS group, which are the forever chemicals, there's thousands in this group.
Right.
The two that we know the most about and that have been studied the most are PFOS and PFOA. It's a little bit confusing, but they're the two, and they're the ones that have been studied the most. PFOA was used in Teflon. PFOS was used in Scotchgard and food packaging paper, and they were used for decades, but now they have been phased out. But most famously, PFOS was also used in firefighting foam, which is probably what people are most familiar with, and that was used over decades all over the world to suppress mainly oil fires, but it was actually used in enormous quantities for training as well.
And it was also used in training at the Williamstown Air Force Base north of Newcastle for many, many years. And there's now an admission from our Defence Force that it has actually contributed to the death of so many in that community, right?
I'm not sure if the Defence Force has admitted that. I think that the global science has linked these chemicals to a number of health issues, and cancer is one of them. The Australian government at the moment hasn't acknowledged those health issues associated with these chemicals, but the global science has made these links. And yes, there's been stories coming out of Williamtown of cancer clusters there, and in a number of other communities as well that are highly exposed to these chemicals.
Now, in this documentary, the multinational giant 3M is in the firing line. I want to play a snippet which illustrates the extent of the camouflage used by 3M to cover their culpability. Let's play that.
What 3M knew and when they knew it.
I mean, if you think about the amount of effort 3M has spent over the years to keep this under wraps, to make sure that people didn't see this evidence. And again, it's just remarkable to me that we're now having to prepare these cases to go to trial, to get these people to accept responsibility for what they did. And there's no doubt who did it.
If you wanted to deliberately contaminate the planet with PFAS, you couldn't have invented a better delivery device than firefighting foam, where you're literally spraying it into the environment, into the water, and don't do anything to clean it up. And just let it soak in, let it leach through the ground, into the aquifers, into people's drinking water. And that's exactly what they did.
How long has 3M known about the poisons contained in their products, Katrina?
So in 1975, some outside researchers who weren't a part of 3M were doing their own research into by collecting pooled blood at blood banks in the United States for a separate research study. And while they were doing that, they kept coming across this particular chemical. So they reached out to 3M because they knew 3M was manufacturing chemicals like that. And they asked if that was potentially one of 3M's chemicals. At the time, 3M pled ignorance and said, we don't think so. But internally and their own documents then revealed that they did actually know that that was their chemical. And so from 1975, 3M were aware that this chemical was in the blood of the general population in the US and subsequently most likely around the world because the products that they came from, the Scotch Guard, the firefighting foam and the food packaging paper, those products were being sold internationally at that point.
1975, how long did it take for anyone, any government, to do something about it?
Well, at that time, 3M didn't reveal it to the EPA. They sort of kept that information to themselves, and it wasn't actually until the late 90s that they did report to the EPA that the chemical was in the blood of the general population, and they then handed over a number of their own studies into the chemicals. So the governments around the world weren't aware, and the EPA in the US wasn't aware until the late 90s that this chemical had made its way into the blood of the population around the world.
How has 3M reacted to the documentary?
Well, I don't know if they've seen it yet, but we reached out for them for comment during the process of making the film. 3M phased out the two chemicals that I mentioned earlier in the 2000s and replaced a lot of their products with other PFAS chemicals. Experts do say that a number of those other chemicals do exhibit similar traits to the two that we know the most about, the toxic traits. They bioaccumulate in the blood or they are persistent. So the reason they're called forever chemicals is they never break down in the environment. So 3M's comment is that all of their products are safe for their intended purposes, but they have also announced that they will be phasing out all PFAS production by 2025. And that seems to be a global movement. It's not just 3M that make these chemicals now. There are 11 other companies that make these chemicals. But it's being globally recognized now that we don't want these chemicals in products, in our homes, in our blood. And so the fact that they are being phased out is good news.
It is good news, but the $64,000 question is, you just wonder whether there's any causation between these chemicals and, you know, the amount of cancer diagnoses that we see around the world.
Yeah, that's right. So the World Health Organization just recently has deemed PFOA as a human carcinogen. That chemical has been studied the most. So they are confident now, and the US EPA has also said that PFOS, which is the chemical that was in the firefighting foam, is likely to cause cancer and also likely to cause suppression of the immune system, you know, infertility issues. It's got a whole list of things that they are linking this to. The issue that the international science has is that because no one knew about these chemicals until the late 90s and early 2000s. We are behind in being able to really research these chemicals. But the fact that the World Health Organization has now come out to say PFOA is a carcinogen is a big step. And there are studies going on all over the world that are also linking these chemicals to really serious health issues.
I've got to take a quick break. I want to talk about the involvement of Mark Ruffalo, otherwise known as the Hulk for some of us pop movie watchers, but Mark Ruffalo involved in the documentary, and he, of course, having his own personal curiosity about what's been going on in terms of some of these forever chemicals. We'll come back and talk about that and more with Katrina McGowan. And of course, that film, if you would like to download it, you can stream it. Revealed, How to Poison a Planet. It's available on Stan. We'll take a break and come back with more right here on TNT.
TNT's James Freeman.
Proposals to construct a global censorship and information control operation led by the WHO have also been dropped. Thank God for that. What the hell has the WHO got to do with censoring online information? Provisions proposed to expand the scope of the IHR to include all risks with potential to impact public health, including climate change, and food supply, well, they have also been deleted. The scope now remains essentially unchanged, which is all about the spread of disease.
James Freeman on today's News Talk TNT.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702. Or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
Are we on the air?
Am I on the air?
You're on the air.
On the air 24/7. Your news talk giant, TNT.
I'm speaking with Katrina McGowan, and we're talking about this documentary on Stan. You've got the Hulk, Mark Ruffalo, linking some of the cases in the documentary. He's already starred in another movie detailing a similar case against DuPont. I just want to play this before I ask you a question about his involvement. Have a look at this.
Ended up being on the cover of the New York Times Magazine. After that story came out, one of the people that apparently had seen the story and reached out to me was Mark Ruffalo.
You knew. Still, you did nothing.
Dark Waters tells the true story of Robert Ballot, the underdog lawyer who took on the industrial giant DuPont Chemical.
You want to take everything that you know and turn it against an iconic American company like an informant. Isn't that right? Isn't that right? Isn't that right?
Yes.
Yeah. Katrina, the Dark Waters movie wasn't just a movie. He has a genuine personal interest in these kinds of contaminations, doesn't he?
Yeah, so obviously once Mark made that film, he became aware of this huge issue with PFAS chemicals and continued the fight with Rob Ballot, who he plays in the film, who's an incredible lawyer that was the first to expose these chemicals. And he continued the fight in the US. He's been campaigning. He spoke at Capitol Hill, and he is an advocate for the environment in general, but particularly this issue due to his involvement in Dark Waters. So, he's taken on the fight, and it's fantastic that he's done that because I think that's helped raise awareness as well about these chemicals.
It's one thing to raise awareness about things that you know seem to be unjust. But at the same time, part of the documentary reveals, does it not, that the lawyers go through such a process to try and get a scintilla of information out of, you know, locked vaults of records that exist in places like 3M and DuPont. It's not an easy process, is it?
It's not an easy process. And as Rob Ballot talks about in the film, he first found out about 3M and these chemicals in 2005, and that was when the chemicals were found in the drinking water in Minnesota. And at the time, the state of Minnesota did take 3M to court, but 3M was able to get a blanket protection order, and so none of those documents were able to be revealed to the public until 2018. So Rob and the lawyers involved in that case were unable to share any of these documents until 2018. And just recently, last year, there was a massive nationwide case in the US against 3M, brought by an incredible legal team led by Gary Douglas and his team, Rebecca Newman, and also Ned McWilliams, who are all in the film. And it was their job to put together the story that they were going to take to trial based on tens of thousands of documents that they received through the discovery process. And that case ended up settling on literally on the courthouse steps last year. And it was after that point that the team were then able to share with us that story and hand over some of those documents.
That's interesting. Tell me about whistleblowers. Have whistleblowers played a role in helping the legal teams get to their victories?
I'm not sure about whistleblowers. I think in this case, it's just been the hard slog of legal work and a really dedicated legal team who have just been, going through all of these documents for years, really. And it's been a huge amount of work and a lot due to Rob Ballot, who really was the first one to stand up against what was DuPont at the time. And that was a really, if anyone has seen Dark Waters, you'll be able to see just what he went through to get the story out. But it has just been a huge legal team, really amazing legal team who have just dedicated, almost decades now to trying to bring this story out and to have these companies, face trial and be held accountable.
So what role, like, for instance, iCandy Films, you've produced this thing, you've had assistance from other Australian individuals. Why has it been an Australian production?
Well, this started out as an Australian production because we're an Australian documentary company. It started out just locally. A lot of films start small and then sort of snowball into something bigger. So it was myself, Janine Hosking, who produced the film with me, Matt Cornwell. And we found out about, it was really just the communities in Australia that were suffering from contamination from the firefighting foam, and they were taking on their own litigation in Australia. And once we started to look deeper into that issue, it's natural to then look at, well, where did the foam come from? And it sort of went from there. But it's an Australian film, and it was filmed mostly in Australia and with a whole Australian team. But it has that international storyline and a massive international reach because ultimately these chemicals affect everybody.
Yeah, exactly. You mentioned Janine Hosking, who I used to work with many, many years ago. Is she in the room there with you at the moment, or is she hiding?
No, I'm sorry. She had to jump on a call, but she said to say hello.
Chicken. Chicken. Yeah. I bet the phone starts to ring any minute now. This is interesting. So what's next for the company? Because this is quite an important story to tell. Are you working on something that is as important? And you probably can't tell me about it if you are.
We've always got projects underway. We have one coming out later in the year that Janine has been driving, producing and directing about the about Winx, called A Horse Named Winx, which is going to be in cinemas later in the year.
Right.
And we have other projects that are always going on in the background. I mean, for us, we dedicate so much of ourselves to just one or two projects because we're a small company. So How to Poison a Planet was over 4 years in the making. We pour everything we have into these films. So, we've always got things in the works.
Fantastic. I'll let you go. Thank you very much for your time. Congratulations on Revealed, How to Poison a Planet. Hopefully, governments and EPAs don't turn a blind eye to what you've produced and can hopefully keep up to date with what might be poisoning our water system or is in, being exposed, people are being exposed to here in Australia, not just in the United States. That'd be handy.
Yeah, that would be great. These chemicals are in 98% of the world's population, so it affects us all. They're in our homes, in a whole number of products. And so, regulation would be a really great start. And the government last year did announce that they were going to ban PFOS and PFOA by 2025. But as I mentioned before, there's thousands of these chemicals. But I just hope the film can raise awareness and people can understand that these chemicals are around, because unless you know they're there, you can't really protect yourselves from them. So that's the first start for the film, is just to get this story out there and hope that people engage with it.
TNT Radio News.
Huge news, 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 news.
Matt Boylant here with your TNT headlines. There are fresh hopes of a ceasefire in Gaza as Hamas considers a new proposal for a 40-day truce tabled by Israel. Meanwhile, anger is rising in Tel Aviv, where anti-government protests have ramped up with a vengeance, calling for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to resign over his handling of the war. And AstraZeneca has for the first time admitted in court that its COVID-19 vaccine can cause a rare, deadly blood-clotting side effect.
We're the pinup boys and poster girls for free speech. We just don't look as impressive as Vladimir Putin shirtless on a horse. Yeah. 24/7, 365. We never stop sifting fact from fiction, misinformation from the truth. From government overreach to the latest on mandates, big tech censorship to propaganda gone mad. Listen to TNT Radio and get the news and views direct from our expert presenters and commentators anywhere you go. Ask Alexa or Google to play TNT Radio or download the TNT Radio app for free from the App Store or Google Play. Today's News Talk. This is TNT Radio.
Hey, good to have you back. Sorry, we just had a little bit of a glitch and it clipped off the back end of that interview. But Katrina was fantastic to explain exactly what that documentary series entailed. And it is a story that needs to be told and we need to follow it. Just in terms of our talkback numbers, if you want to be part of the conversation, if you've got something to say about some of the history involved in, you know, big chemical companies, big pharma as well, like DuPont, 3M at the moment, give us a call on our open lines from the United States or Canada on 1-888-201-6425. From the UK, 0330-024-1026. This assisted dying discussion is big news in the UK at the moment. And for those of you listening from there, you may want to add your opinion to what's been discussed. There's been numerous politicians having their say in the last few days, but the feeling is that this will get over the line. We'll soon see. And from Australia or New Zealand, the number on our talkback lines, 1-800-670-310. We mentioned with Mark Latham how terrible the domestic violence predicament is in this country. And one of the reasons why we don't tackle it is because we don't call a spade or a shovel. We don't say that we have the highest number of domestic violence incidents recorded in the Aboriginal communities of Australia. We don't say that. We don't make that quite plain because we're somehow treading carefully against minority groups again. And therefore, we don't know how to fix the problem if we don't admit where the problem is. Statistics tell us where the problems are, but we seem to be, you know, tippy-toeing around the truth, which is never a good thing. Well, it also coincides, this debate about domestic violence, it does coincide with the fact that we've had the worst 18 months in Australian records for women being killed or maimed or injured at the hands of men. It's a fact. We can't dispute the fact. As Mark Latham says, this is a very small percentage of the male population, but it happens and we've got to do something about it. And here I am just looking down at the latest news in one of the news websites and see that there's been another woman, a 19-year-old, found dead at North Bondi. This news came through just after 3 p.m. A man has been arrested after a young woman's death in Sydney's eastern suburbs. This is according to AAP. The 32-year-old man had an outstanding warrant and was arrested at a unit on Hardy Street at North Bondi, where a woman, believed to be aged 19, had been found dead on Tuesday morning, New South Wales Police said in a statement. A crime scene has been set up as the circumstances are investigated, with the woman's cause of death yet to be identified. But they've arrested a man at the scene. Now, that has all the hallmarks, and I may be wrong, it has all the hallmarks of a domestic violent death. Another one, same kind of result, man at the scene or man flees, he's arrested soon after, and it's got to do with domestic violence. It goes on and on and on. And until we find, we look at these problems in a statistical and scientific fashion and work out that putting campaign ads on social media is not the answer, until we realise that we've got to be far more incremental and scientific about this, this will just continue. And it's a terrible blight on where we are up to as a nation. Now, if you're disgusted that the Liberal Party leader, Peter Dutton, sided with the Greens and the Labor government and supported the eSafety Commissioner's censorship of that footage that came out of Wakeley 3 weeks ago, well, you're not alone. I've said it here. How dare the opposition, how dare a Conservative Party say that we should censor before we become transparent? How dare they go down this path? The Liberal Party can no longer be called Conservative and in so many ways has lost touch with its traditional base and the bulk of the Australian population. And that's certainly been you know, the retort of so many who've been connected to the party for many, many years after the last federal election. My next guest has many concerns specifically in this area. Matthew Kemenzuli started a software company for the building industry in 2002 from his bedroom. His vision grew into a multi-million dollar business. Matt served on the state executive of the New South Wales Liberal Party and has spent a lifetime effort fighting corruption in the party. Now expelled from the Liberal Party, he presents a model for Liberal Party reform, which he describes as a no-nonsense blueprint for the rescue of the Liberal Party. He joins me live from Sydney. Matt Kemenzuli, welcome back to TNT.
Hey, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. So much to talk about. Can I go back to your expulsion from the Liberal Party, firstly, under the orders of Prime Minister Scott Morrison? You ended up in the High Court, a High Court legal battle with the Prime Minister. How long did you have concerns about the party's direction before that particular battle went so public?
Well, look, I mean, my frustrations with the party probably went back almost as far, probably as far as 2012.
Right.
When I'd seen the weaponization of the Nomination Review Committee, the NRC process, to try and curate candidates. So the Nomination Review is something that the party does to vet candidates, to sort of, it's supposed to, you know, for want of a better set of terms, you know, get the axe murderers out of the room, right? So you basically, anybody who is a bankrupt or is a bad person in some way or another, has real blights on their character, shouldn't be allowed to run for office as a Liberal. I don't think anybody disputes that. But what we started to see was that the administration wing of the party was using it to get authentic candidates out of the race, people who they disagree with on policy, see? So it's easy to have pre-selections, I guess, when you've curated the field down to, you know, somebody who you like.
So all of a sudden, it wasn't about protecting the party from any kind of retribution or reputational damage. It was there for philosophical and policy changes.
Correct. And we've seen it be used for that ever since. I mean, it's happening less and less now since the battle that we had back in the all the way up to the High Court. The party's doing a better job of following the Constitution, which was undergoing reform since at least 2012 in this space, and heavily involved in those sorts of things. People like Tony Abbott were big proponents for things like the Warringah Motion, party reform, you know, democratisation of the party.
To make sure that the rank and file had
a say.
They weren't constantly ticked off for making a decision.
That's exactly right. So the idea is to... So the NRC being weaponized or used to curate candidates is one set of problems. The delaying of NRCs from happening at all, which is what Alex Hawke did at the last federal, or at least that was the charge, and I made that.
Well, that was an abomination
statement. Yeah, and that was something that didn't go defended. In fact, that was, you know, we put that claim a couple of times, and it didn't get defended at all. So ultimately, they were using process and some gaps in process to thwart democracy. They used NRCs to thwart democracy. We saw it happen to Noel McCoy at the state level as well, where, you know, because he took a certain view on the Liberal Party's view on things like the COVID response, he wasn't allowed to run. That's just silly. That's not what NRCs are for. We're supposed to have democratic selections. We're supposed to let any person who believes that they can contribute to come and contribute and allow people to stand in front of a jury of their peers and be selected or not. But the idea behind good quality selections is getting good quality representation so we can start to get the sort of leadership into the place that we need. Authentic Liberals with authentic Liberal policy positions. And the party's been standing against it for too long. It is changing. We are making headway. There is a democratization happening again. There's a big push in that space. We're driving it. You know, did very, very well at the AGM, got the state down to the state presidency down to one vote. You know, Don Harwin's now the president of the division. He won that by one vote out of 700 and something votes. And that's in dispute right now. We're still waiting to see where that dispute goes. You know, will Don be the president after the disputes panel's looked at it? I don't know. I don't know. I think there's some valid concerns. So we'll see where that lands.
So yeah. What do you propose for an additional reform for the Liberal Party?
Well, look, I think one, they need to start to push some of the elections and selections out to something like a neutral organization, like the New South Wales Electoral Commission.
Right.
Let the New South Wales Electoral Commission conduct the AGMs and even the pre-selections. Other organizations do that. So that way we can be sure that there's, you know, good quality process. Justice doesn't just have to be done, it has to be seen to being done. So ideally we'd like to see that. We'd like to see them actually stick to the Constitution. The Constitution is not terrible. Some reforms, maybe taking the Nomination Review Committee out and going back to a two-part question. Let the electorate decide. People already have to sign a statutory declaration. All the Nomination Review should really do is check to see the statutory declaration is correct. And that's it.
Yeah.
We need to know that people aren't criminals or aren't bankrupts, are valid. I don't have constitutional issues with, say, citizenship. Once all that's sorted, let them face a jury of the selectors in the area and get quality assurance through the place. And let the Liberal members pick the Liberal candidates.
In some ways, and I've always thought that it was all about face. It was all about wrong way around. What actually should happen is that you should have an executive look at who's able to stand as the candidate for a seat and work out the anomalies that might exist, and then put a number of them forward for the local branch to decide who will be their local member. It's all around the wrong way.
I think that's right. Ideally, you want to be in a situation where if people want to put their name forward and run as Liberals, let the other Liberals work out whether or not that's a good idea.
Yeah.
We've seen them work quite well. People like Simon Kennedy in Cook did a cracker job. He's won two pre-selections in areas that, people will have claimed were very factionalized areas, and he broke through without factional support and won pre-selections.
Yeah.
That's what you want, quality candidates.
Yeah, exactly. I want to talk further about the New South Wales Liberal Party, though. There's an obsession at the moment with what's happening at local government levels, and yet we're on the eve of another federal election. We're less than 12 months away from a federal election, which is still up in the air as to who might win. It'd be a rarity for the Labor Party to be a one-term wonder. And so, therefore, shouldn't the New South Wales Liberal Party be working hard to get federal members nominated and federal members interested in nominating, as opposed to being obsessed with what's happening at local government level? What's that about?
Well, you'd think so, right? You really would think that they'd be focused on the federal election. I don't think since Kevin Rudd has there been a leader that is so weak on the Labor side. I mean, everything Albo touches, he seems to have a reverse Midas touch. It all turns to lead and sinks.
And having said that, they've protected him so well, but he can't help himself.
That's right. Everything he does seems to be a gaffe or a mistake. So why the Liberal Party sitting there worrying about local council, which is a subset of the state government? People don't understand how obsessed the Liberal Party is right now with council. They think it's a pathway to winning seats because they've seen, some independents do that. But look, and there is just some argument that if the Labor Party's showing up, then the Liberal Party needs to show up as well. There's an argument for that. But it's not the raison d'etre of the Liberal Party.
No, and there are lots of examples of that not working that way.
Well, look, sometimes it can have the reverse effect. I mean, there's Liverpool right now is a council that has all sorts of problems, Liberal on Liberal. One of them's joined the HSU, or the USU, sorry. USU is now out there advocating for the former president of the upper house from the Liberal Party, right? In some kind of dispute, you've got a mayor there that is, who knows what he's thinking, Liberal as well. I think sometimes it can have a negative impact on the brand. And what's important is good policy and good quality candidates. And if the party focused on good policy and good quality candidates and less focus on rates, roads and rubbish and a subset of state government being local council, we need to go back to calling it council. It's not local government. It is council.
Yeah.
It's council. It's not council. Even, it's not a form of government.
Yeah, it's very true. They give them a higher entitlement than they deserve by calling it a government. All right, I want to talk about, let's move away from all of that. We've now raised some of the issues, the problems, but the steps forward that the New South Wales Liberal Party are making at the moment. Let's talk about the federal level. And I've never seen a debate about freedom of speech being so highly ranked at the moment as it is in this country, which I think is a fantastic thing. Cabinet Minister Tanya Plibersek has doubled down, though, on the government's call for censorship and its attack on Elon Musk. Here's what she said yesterday.
This Elon Musk position on censorship on X is absolutely driving me crazy. You know, you cannot show all sorts of things like child pornography, like people being murdered in the mainstream media. You shouldn't be able to show it on social media. What Elon Musk is saying is that he needs to be able to show graphic, violent content on the platform, or somehow people's human rights are being infringed. No one is saying that the Wakely stabbing should not have been reported. That would be censorship. Preventing the video from being shown again and again and again and again for the titillation of the X audience, that's not censorship. That's common decency.
How many holes in that argument, Matthew?
Oh, look, I think that it's more like a colander. It's just insane. I mean, to suggest that the public right to know, the public's right to know, is somehow put second to sensitivities when it comes to major incidents. I mean, I remember many years ago now watching people jump off the Twin Towers on mainstream media. Terribly sad, terribly, horribly sad things. I remember even as a young boy when I got my CD version of the, you know, Microsoft Encarta Encyclopedia, watching over and over and over again the JFK shooting to try and understand what it was that I was seeing. I mean, that was all stuff that was readily available. That was horrendous stuff, horrendous stuff. You know, when you are talking about platforms that are largely there for adults, with proper child protection already built in their terms and conditions, terms of service, and them going around policing that. Never before have I opened the X app and seen child pornography, and nor should you.
No,
no one's arguing for that.
No, that's not there.
And it's illegal content. That's illegal. And it's not something that's there. So, you know, and they work very, very hard on that. I think, though, that there is an argument for the public's right to know. But I think there's something far more sinister, Chris, in this, and that is that this government doesn't like criticism of any nature at all.
No.
They are conflating this issue of, you know, a video that may have gone around the internet with things like joke memes, where we saw Albo talking about the eSafety Commission going around taking memes down because people on the internet make joke memes sometimes. But for mine, and this is where it gets really serious, we've always spoken truth to power through humor. Always spoken truth to power through humor. Whether you go back to, you know, the old English court jester who would sit there and, you know, make fun of the king and the only person who could, you know, Shakespeare would skirt a lot of lines. The old sitcoms. We know that the powerful people used to go home and watch sitcoms too, and get all of that. That, you know, and then you have the D Generation and Saturday Night Live lambasting. I mean, these are the sorts of only ways that the average person can communicate back to government. And now we have this wonderful platform, these wonderful abilities to communicate directly. I would be embracing that. Were I the leader of the country right now, I'd be frantically, I'm not frantically look at X as it is, but I'd be frantically looking at X and trying to see what people are saying and what they are thinking, and seeing how I could measure myself against people's expectations and whether or not that all measures against my ideology. I mean, isn't this all good stuff? Shouldn't we be jumping in to these sorts of things rather than running away from them and trying to ban memes, ban free speech, ban communication?
And sometimes you've just got to weigh up the extent of the violence, and I think this was a moderately violent piece of footage, moderately. You've got to weigh up the showing of a moderately violent piece of footage to the essential item at stake here, which is Islamic extremism, and the fact that this is a monumental news story, and this should create discussion and create some kind of change in the way our governments control the problem. You don't have any of that if you don't show the video.
Well, look, a number of commentators around the place have said that, you know, it may well fuel conspiracy theories when people can't see. yep. what's going on.
Yeah.
People then start to make up stories.
Correct.
And it gets very, very, very dangerous.
Yeah.
And I think that's right. I also think that when you start to force free information underground, it makes it even more sought after. So then you start finding that it'll be the kids, it'll be the young people that then go seeking it first and foremost.
Yeah.
And they'll be the ones who show their parents. The idea that, you know, kids are silly is out of control. But there are certain parental controls that already exist, right?
Yeah.
So you turn those things on. But if you push this stuff underground, then it starts to become some kind of contraband, free information.
Yes.
Knowledge, wisdom.
Yes.
Then
correct.
People will seek it out, and kids in particular. So you've got to give people their right to see it.
Which brings us to the misinformation and disinformation bill. We've got no major party against this idea, except the public should be railing against it right now.
That's right. Look, I think there's been a lot of outcry. I think Mr. Dutton started to look more at this with a sideways glance, similar to what he was doing with The Voice. I don't think he's being entirely as strong as we'd like.
No.
But I do think he's taking steps away from support. And I think that elements of his party are strongly against it.
Mm.
And I think that's the right side of history.
Yeah.
And I think we need to see the Liberals take an even stronger stance against it.
Mm.
Because if the major parties both line up on something like this, what do they say? Democracy dies with a whimper.
Yeah, exactly.
That's where we end up.
And I'm going to talk about this on the program tomorrow because it caters for a larger explanation. But this has been printed in the Capital Brief in the last 24 hours. A document seen by Capital Brief shows, and was distributed, by the way, by the Prime Minister's office, to all ministerial officers in recent weeks, sets out a point-by-point explanation as to how to avoid answering questions of multiple departments in the future. It suggests, and the document suggests, the Albanese government feels vulnerable over the performance of departments and agencies in Senate estimates. This publication revealed in February that the Department of Home Affairs blindsided its two ministers, Claire O'Neill and Andrew Giles, when it tabled new details about the High Court's NZYQ case. In other words, they got terribly embarrassed by all of that when a public servant got in front of the Senate Estimates Committee and told the truth. And now they're doing all they can. Supposedly, this government that got in on the basis of being transparent, they're doing all they can to make sure that ministers know how to avoid the truth.
Yeah.
That tells me that they want misinformation and disinformation so that it can use it for government narrative.
I think the biggest risk that we have is to allow the government to become the single source of truth, Chris. I think we've seen many times through history where either through incompetence or, you know, whether it's misfeasance or malfeasance, it is of no consequence. It looks the same in hindsight.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, whenever you just let one side of the story out, and it's the side of the story that the vested interest groups and the government and the people in power want you to have, then you really are misinformed. You are entirely misinformed.
Exactly. I want to get two other questions in before I get to our news. I'm only 3 minutes away. Senator Gerard Rennick has made legal moves against the Queensland division of the Liberal Party. Where do you see this headed?
Well, look, I know a little bit about the situation. I'm hopefully he's got a case. I think what we're seeing is the administration wing of the Queensland division. This is catching hold up and down the East Coast, doing everything they can, hope against hope, to try and maintain power and control and send people into Parliament that will not support Peter Dutton's leadership.
Yeah,
that's what this is all about. What you've got to understand why this matters, and we all saw them roll Tony Abbott. We saw the democratically elected Prime Minister get rolled by Malcolm Turnbull. We saw that happen. And what the moderate forces in the party want to do is jam more people in that will effectively, you know, put another moderate leader in so they can go off and do whatever it is that they want to do again.
Yep.
And that's not why people vote Liberal. If they wanted Teals and Labor members, they'd vote Teal and Labor. They would vote Liberal.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I've never seen a moderate Liberal in the wild.
Exactly. Tell me about the meme competition you're running online, offering a prize for the best Albo-directed meme.
Yeah. So there are three categories, right? So it's on my Twitter. Go to my Twitter. It's pretty easy. If you just search my name, Matt Camenzulli, you'll find my Twitter page. And you will find that there is a competition, $500 first prize for each category, a T-shirt printed, with your meme and a cut of $7.50 for every t-shirt sold by Aussie Bot and his in his factory there making t-shirts. So, you know, we want free speech. I want a lot of memes. I want to see as many memes as we can get. Original memes, new memes, fresh memes, you know, because again, newspaper cartoons are more easily accessed to the public now. You can make your own. You can get them out there online. Some of these things go absolutely viral. Be clever. Be creative. Don't be rude. We don't want anything crass or rude. We want it something that you would proudly walk around with on a t-shirt in front of the kiddies. But make the points.
Something
the
cleverly points. Cynical, right?
Absolutely cynical. We're Australians, right? We're supposed to be larrikins. We're supposed to be, you know, the sorts that don't salute. Well, we don't, you know, we don't like people being a little bit too full of themselves. Show them. Show them. Remind the Labor Party. Remind Anthony Albanese that he's just an Aussie.
Yes, exactly. We should do that. Exactly. Mate, thank you very much for your time today. We've gone through a whole heap of issues locally and more nationally. And I do hope that someone in the parliament puts up their dukes over the misinformation and disinformation bill, because by the sound of it, it's all one-way traffic for it, which is the sad part about it. Thank you, Matthew.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time. Matthew Kemenzuli. There you go. It's interesting. The meme for his, I should mention, all you got to do is go to Matthew Kemenzuli, C-A-M-E-N-Z-U-L-I, and you'll find his X account, and that's where you can lodge your very clever but very cynical Albo-oriented meme. And there are three different prizes that he's giving away. But why not? A healthy bit of piss-taking is not such a bad thing, I would have thought. I've got to hand over the reins to Sonia Poulton, who comes to you, of course, from the UK. We'll be back to do it again at the same time, Wednesday already tomorrow. Where's the week going? And hopefully you can tell your friends and tell your family to come and join us. This is where we stand up for freedom. This is where we expose government control. And there's a lot of that to do at the moment, especially here in Australia. This is Chris Smith on TNT.